We'll get to hear Sunday out of that office.
Yes, indeed.
So, Paul said hello.
He said hey to you. He's listening too, man. All right, y'all, we got to get out of here. The show has, I mean, it's been great. It went by extremely fast. As John Lee Johnson, our predecessor, would say, stay out of trouble. But as Paul Muth likes to say, and I agree, get in the right kind of trouble. Peace and much love to you. Soon, we'll talk to you in a little bit, brother.
Later.
All right, later.
Protocols too here.
Yeah, we seem to
be safe.
You be safe too.
Yeah.
So much is going on. I know your show gonna be powerful. We'll be listening.
Okay, Mumia's gonna be talking about how COVID is treating him in jail. He's in lockdown most of the time, is what it translates to. And may have another segment about the vector that our prison system is, as we have so many people incarcerated. We got to decarcerate for public health, as the motto goes. I was participating with that on May Day, the rally from the Champaign County Bail Reform Group. All right, I'm a little bit breathless. Glad that caller got in. I was trying to give him the phone number down here. Fly Live is the main number, but we don't have letters on our phones much anymore, so it's kind of hard to translate. Anyway, details. It's Virginia Sperry. I recognize the name. We'll get a little segment of her. She has a long piece on The Intercepted about incarceration and the vector for COVID that is. I guess there's a town in Texas called Palestine that has four penitentiaries, or some level of jails in the area. It was economic development for the rural Texan area, which is how it's treated here somewhat too. But now we're seeing what comes with that unhealthy circumstance. It's already a scandal about how lacking of hygiene there already was in the U.S. incarceration system. So Noel Hanrahan, who does the Prison Radio Project, prisonradio.org, I believe, conducts a bit of an interview with Mumi about his circumstance, and that is the commentary for this week. Amy's got something about Trump and the Navajo Nation. He was down in Arizona, pretty close to where the highest percentage of outbreak is, say, for New Jersey and New York, the Dene Nation. So that's her commentary. I'm going to try and play a little bit of a regular monthly feature that I do. I played the entirety of it last week from the TaxCast, taxjustice.net in the UK. They have interesting perspective on the US. Greg Palast has election theft report. And then a bit about the machinations of our Senate leader, Mitch McConnell, and the rather arbitrary way he's running the Senate, when people ought to be talking about the impact, even if they don't want to do legislation, maybe they should be conducting studies into how things are working out. They said they want to wait before another tranche of relief goes ahead to see how this is working. But they're not even talking about it at the Senate. They're talking about getting a crony of Kavanaugh's, on the district court, which is a straight line to the Supreme Court, actually. It's a pretty insidious tale. 37-year-old guy. All right, that's the rundown. Let's see how much of that we can get on. I might have a time for a personal moment of silence. Lost a friend of mine to depression this past week. I know a lot of people in the community are suffering from it, and please don't let your demons and your nightmares overwhelm you, as it did to Nick. It's a really sad circumstance. All right, Well, you can have your own moment of silence. Maybe go out to your backyard and commune a little bit. I talked about him about his nightmares, and I thought he had relief from them, but apparently not. There's studies about how much this change of life is affecting how many dreams we recall. So I guess maybe he was recalling his nightmares. All right, 6 minutes in. Thanks for listening. I hope this goes smoothly. Behind the News coming up. I think I already checked in on him this week. He's got a great show. That's Doug Henwood. Gene will be running the midday part of your Saturday. If you choose to listen, I hope you do. Got some good stuff coming up. She'll be running that remotely from over in lovely West Urbana. All right, here's Mumia. This is a longer segment than typical, and that'll be good because I'm still getting set up here.
Well, we don't see much because we're locked up 23 hours and 15 minutes every day. That is to say, everybody in prison all across the state of Pennsylvania are under this emergency decree of, it was March 13th or 15th. Ever since then, we've been locked down 23 hours and 15 minutes. So you're out of the cell 45 minutes a day. It can be morning, afternoon, or night. But in that 45 minutes, you gotta bathe, you can call a friend or family, you can get on the kiosk, you can clean your cell. Other than that, you're locked in your cell. It's like the whole state is a hole, H-O-L-E now. And that's how it was on death row. That's how it was in the hole. Well, it's like that all around now in the name of health. We've heard that people have been sick, mostly in Phoenix, which is near Philadelphia. But there have been other outbreaks, but there isn't a lot of coverage of that. The counties seem to have been getting it the worst. Of course, they're closest to the community. You know, people are coming in and going out. And I'm speaking of staff members, volunteers, visitors, you name it. But what happens in the counties makes its way to the state. It's just a matter of time. I think mass incarceration has become, I hate to say it, but I believe it, normalized. That is to say, for all intents and purposes, who gives a damn? And, you know, while your family or your loved ones might care, the so-called average American, even the average American who is himself locked down in his home or her home, they find this intolerable. They find it outrageous. They're going nuts. But, you know, Pennsylvania, New York, under the crazy Rockefeller drug laws, all across the country, you've got millions of people who are locked down. You know, for years in Pennsylvania, for decades, like Maroon Schultz and other people who've been locked down for decades in solitary confinement. And so, you know, people are getting a taste of this, even though it's a relaxed, distant taste. It's a taste because you can't go out when you want to go out. You can't leave. You're locked in. And it's safer, to be frank. And, you know, what we've seen is people kind of burst loose and I hope I missed my guess. I hope I'm wrong. But I have a sneaking suspicion that we're going to see a second wave in this country. And the fact that it's already the country with the highest number of COVID-19 related deaths tells me we're going to see some really great days and some really high numbers. The numbers are jumping. It must be 2,000 a day, 1,300 to 2,500 a day. And those numbers are rising. In the last few weeks, they've gone from hundreds to tens of thousands.
You know, how does it feel to you about the fact that even though a virus doesn't discriminate, we've seen that it right now does discriminate?
Well, because it follows the economic realities of the system in which it operates. That is to say, the people who are in touch with the public, the bus drivers, the nurses, many of the doctors, police, fire, a lot of them, especially in the big cities, are Black and Puerto Rican. out there, you know, to feed their families, support their families, and they're in contact. And many of them have very little protection. They're being treated like, essentially, they call them essential workers, but they're being treated essentially like all workers.
They're like, you know, they're like, they're like disposable workers.
They are. So if you really are honest about it, to call them essential workers is a lie. It's like calling a prison a correctional institution. You know what I know, they don't do much correcting here. All they do is harass people and make them worse. Essential workers are really disposable workers. They're the people, and you know, as the news has caught up with that reality, and we've gotten the reporting of, say, 60% of the people who are dying in New York are Black and Latino, you've seen other parts of the state, the United States, whiter parts of the state, saying, come on, unlock us, we're not those guys. And we're seeing that. So they're really disposable to the economic and political system.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
We don't usually hear her interjecting. It's prisonradio.org, I believe, again. We're going to go right to Amy Goodman's commentary, and then we're going to have a little soundbite from her headlines covering the non-prosecution of Flynn. There's a lot of argument in the circles I've been watching about it. I'm still a skeptic of the whole Russia connection. That doesn't mean that his activities as representing Turkey and importuning the Russian ambassador about Israel shouldn't be ignored. They are being deep-sixed. Maybe somebody will start investigating that because so many people are angry about the circumstance. In a lighthearted moment, I mentioned that Martha Stewart ought to be exonerated from her convictions because she got entrapped and was charged merely with lying to the FBI. She wasn't charged for the underlying stock manipulations or some kind of things that she was doing. I don't know the truth or the falsity of those accusations, but that's right. But that's not what she was convicted of and spent some time in the clink, actually. People don't remember that. And the point is, you don't have to defend the FBI to say that they may have had something to investigate with Flynn. May not have linked to a broader issue, though. 13 minutes in, I'm not going to get everything on. I do have to get the election theft report on. He's talking about the New York primary a little bit because there's a back and forth argument going on about you can't just fold up the primary. Sanders suspended his campaign, but he announced that he wanted to get as many delegates. But then we don't need no blanking delegates, do we? Let's do acclamation.
Trump can't mask his message to Indian country, live and let die. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. The COVID-19 pandemic has hit the Diné Navajo people hard, inflicting the highest per capita infection rate in the country after New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, and Massachusetts. The Navajo Nation is the largest reservation in the country, larger than West Virginia, straddling Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, and Utah. Half of the over 300,000 enrolled members reside on the reservation. Navajo President Jonathan Nez has issued some of the strongest stay-at-home measures in the country, including a weekday evening curfew and a complete stay-at-home curfew for the entire weekend. Nearby Gallup, New Mexico, with a large Diné population, has enacted a complete lockdown with the National Guard prohibiting entry. As of May 5th, despite these efforts, there were 2,559 confirmed COVID-19 cases on the Navajo Nation and 79 deaths. Among the victims, 28-year-old Valentina Blackhorse, a beloved champion of Navajo culture and a community leader. She left behind her partner, Robbie Jones, and their 1-year-old daughter, Poet.
Valentina, she loved her immediate family, her parents, her sisters, her nieces and nephews. She loved her elderly. She loved children. She was a kind and hard, hardworking lady, and she was warm-hearted. One thing she would do anything for her immediate family.
That's Valentina's partner, Robbie Jones, speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour. Jones is a detention officer with the Navajo Department of Corrections. He contracted COVID-19 at work.
When she was taking care of me, I guess she contracted it. She started showing symptoms of being shortness of breath, body aches, loss of taste and smell. When I started feeling better, and that's when she started feeling sick.
Valentina Blackhorse tested positive for COVID-19 on April 22nd. She died the next day. She'd won numerous pageants, being named Miss Western Navajo and Miss Dine College, among others, and hoped to run for office in the Navajo Nation government one day. Dr. Michelle Tom is a member of the Navajo Nation as well. She's a family physician at Winslow, Arizona, just across the Navajo reservation line. She spoke about Valentina's death on Democracy Now!
As a reflection of what we're going through as a people, and it correlates with what this virus can do to our young, as someone who is very motivated, loved our culture, spread our culture, our rich and strong, and our language. And that's what we're trying to fight for. And she was going to lead our next generation. And so it was a hard loss for our community.
The Navajo Nation, along with the nearby Hopi, Pueblo, Zuni, and Gila River indigenous communities, have endured despite centuries of genocide, oppression, and systemic racism and poverty. The novel coronavirus pandemic is afflicting them disproportionately, as it has African American and Latinx populations across the U.S. Access to water is challenging on the Navajo reservation. Again, Dr. Michelle Tom.
That's from a long state of histories with treaties and our relationship to government, and our infrastructure for water has never been at the capacity where we can provide water for everyone on the reservation. So you're telling people to wash their hands for 20 seconds, and yet people are trying just to get water, just to drink, and just to cook with.
President Donald Trump made a rare trip during the pandemic Tuesday, visiting an Arizona N95 mask factory where he ignored factory rules by not wearing a mask. Guns N' Roses blared from a factory sound system, playing the song Live and Let Die. It's not clear if it was a coincidental music choice or not. President Trump also met with elected officials, including Navajo Nation Vice President Myron Leiser. The Navajo Nation joined a lawsuit filed by numerous Native tribes against Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin for his abject failure in disbursing $8 billion promised to Native American tribes in the CARES Act.
So the amount of money that's being sent to Indian country, as we call it, is the largest amount in the history of the U.S., and you deserve it, and you've been through a lot.
That's President Trump speaking to Navajo Vice President Leiser.
The Navajo Nation will soon receive over $600 million. That's a lot. Should I renegotiate that? Can we renegotiate that?
But there was no laughter back on the Navajo reservation. Navajo President Jonathan Nez said today the federal government announced they intend to release a portion of funds appropriated by Congress over a month ago to tribes to help fight COVID-19, but I'll believe it when I see it. He went on, "We couldn't sit around and wait for those dollars, so we've had boots on the ground in nearly 20 communities giving out food, water, firewood, protective masks, and other supplies." Navajo President Jonathan Nez himself tested positive for the virus. He concluded, "We lost many of our beloved relatives and family members to this virus, but our teachings also tell us to move forward. We will and we are," he said. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
That is absolutely bizarre. I hadn't heard it all the way to the end. Trump joking about breaking another treaty, apparently. So much going on. I have this little sound clip from Amy's headlines. And I was going to do the search. I haven't done it yet. The argument that they're making is that this is the fruit of a poison tree or something. The idea that the Flynn's cases have to be withdrawn because it was predicated on a lie or something like that. I'm not going to defend the FBI, but I'm not going to take Barr's word for it either. But here's a soundbite that conveys where Barr is really coming from, it seems to me. It's very short. It's time for this. Then maybe I'll meander a little bit before we get to, I guess we'll get to Greg Palast next, the election theft report, which is a weekly feature. And then maybe something from the monthly feature. Okay.
The Justice Department has dropped charges against President Trump's disgraced former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, even though Flynn twice pled guilty to lying to the FBI about his communications with the Russian ambassador to the United States. Attorney General Bill Barr called the move an easy decision. He spoke with CBS reporter Catherine Herridge.
When history looks back on this decision, how do you think it will be written?
Well, history is written by the winner, so it largely depends on who's writing the history.
That's the frank assessment from Barr. It doesn't have anything to do with legality. It has to do with power. And it's pretty shocking. I didn't hear that soundbite anywhere else in my myriad listening to public radio outputs. I think I'll try and circulate that line because it's pretty telling. All right, Palace, I just said, so why don't we do that? This is with Dennis Bernstein from the middle of the week, roughly, election theft report. Pretty spiffy stuff.
Now, the virus that we're talking about having to do, you know, a lot of people think that goes away in April with the heat.
But we have it so well under control. It's going to disappear. One day it's like a miracle. It will disappear.
Now the Democrats are politicizing the coronavirus. And this is their new hoax.
Well, I think treatment in many ways might be more exciting.
You know, we have thousands or hundreds of thousands of people that get better just by, you know, sitting around and even going to work. Some of them go to work, but they get better.
You are an idiot.
And you're listening to our regular edition of the Election Crimes Bulletin with Greg Palast. Greg, welcome back. Mario Cuomo has been overruled. He canceled the New York primary, but that's not the end of the story, is it?
No, it's and Andrew Cuomo. He's okay, so you have 224 delegates, pledged delegates, and 46 superdelegates that come out of New York. Andrew Cuomo, who there's a rumor about, which I'm sure he started, that he would be the best vice presidential candidate, or even, you know, a skullduggery afoot to have him replace Joe Biden for reasons that need not be repeated. So he could become the favorite son and have control of the entire delegation. Now, the way that Cuomo decided to do this is get the state Democratic Committee, I used to be a state Democratic Committee member, by the way, state Democratic Committee to vote to bar delegates from running who are pledged to candidates who have suspended their campaigns. That means Bernie Sanders and Andrew Yang and Elizabeth Warren and others. They haven't ended their campaigns. They're in suspension. So they say, well, if you're in suspension, you don't get to be on the ballot. So that's how democracy works, right? The governor decides who gets to be on the ballot and who doesn't. Well, they could not find a judge to agree with that kind of Putin-esque version of democracy. But Cuomo is appealing the decision by the courts to make the primary go forward. It's been delayed. It's delayed till June 23rd. Hopefully things will be better and clearer then. And I want to give props where they're due to Cuomo, because he did a couple right things. Number one, he said he's sending out to every single voter, and that means voters who are listed as active and those who are voted considered inactive. That's very important to know, Dennis, because and they will all, every one of them will get a postage prepaid postcard saying, do you want to have a mail-in ballot? So that's a very positive move. And the reason I mention this thing about inactive ballots, by the way, is that in Ohio, 1,039,000, over a million voters, were denied the right to even ask for a mail-in ballot if they are on the so-called inactive list. That is, that the state decided you missed a couple elections. Even though federal law says you may never lose your right to vote because you chose not to vote or didn't vote for some reason. So Cuomo did that one right thing. Of course, he canceled the primary to give himself control of the delegation for the convention. So
I have to say it bothers me a little bit because he's in the spotlight, and I get the feeling that he was really trying to rally the support he's getting for his coverage and his dealing with the pandemic to his political gain. And that is bugging me.
Yeah, well, yeah, to say the least. I mean, people are, it's pretty naked. You know, the guy is wants to have power at the convention. And the old school, the old days of the smoke-filled room was you didn't have primaries in most states. The governor and the political leaders of a state picked the delegates to the convention, and that was it. And they decided who would be the nominee. And so Cuomo's trying to revive Tammany Hall-style politics. What's dangerous here and what should make you very uncomfortable is, do we really need someone to give Donald Trump the idea of how one cancels an election? This is a big concern because there is a methodology that's conceivable within the Constitution. If an election is in question, it gets thrown to the House. So you could have some legislatures say it's too dangerous to hold an election, and therefore we will just pass it. We will choose our electors to go to vote for president. As remember, the Florida legislature back in 2000 said we don't care how the voters ultimately voted. Before the recount was done in Florida, the Republicans of the Florida legislature voted to certify all Bush delegates to the Electoral College before the votes were counted. So we have a precedent for this ugly.
Greg's latest book coming out soon, How Trump Stole 2020. Well, Greg, there's somebody else that people are worrying about in terms of stealing votes. He happens to be the president of the United States, and I got a personal note from Stacey Abrams. I know it's personal because she said, "Dear Dennis," but she's worried as hell that the vote steal is on.
Yes, it is. And as you know, the Palace Investigative Fund experts were hired by Stacey Abrams. I should disclose that. We're very concerned about the mass purge of voters that's been going on across the country, from Wisconsin to Michigan, Florida, Ohio, North Carolina, Virginia. These are the swing states, and they're just burning through those voter rolls. And they say, well, wait, but we're talking about, well, one of the issues is mail-in versus not mail-in. The problem is, if you're purged from the voter rolls, or in those states where they say if you're on the inactive list, you just don't get your ballot. And that's really dangerous. I've said this before. I want to repeat it. The MIT study says 22% of all mail-in ballots never get counted. And the number one reason is that people don't get their ballots at all, or they don't get them in time. And if you're on one of these cockamamie purge lists that the Trump cronies have come up with, you're not going to get your ballot. So you can't mail in a ballot if it's not mailed to you. This is a big, big, big problem. And Stacey Abrams is on the front lines with this in Georgia, and raising the cry throughout the country. The only, the only Democratic candidate has actually made this a major issue.
You're listening to the Election Crimes Bulletin. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We do this with Greg Palast, who is also the author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. That's the book and the film. He's got a new book coming out, which is in anticipation of the election steal. And so we're watching this very closely. His new book is How Trump Stole 2020. Greg, back to New York. The people who have supported Bernie Sanders are not crazy about what's going on here, even though Bernie Sanders did sort of step aside after being badgered out of the primaries by the corporate media. He was expecting to have ballots and a vote for the primary. Why do you think he's so furious and his folks are so upset about this?
Well, number one, because I think they have a commitment to, I've talked to Sanders, to Senator Sanders, and he has a real commitment more than any of the other members of the white congressional caucus to voting rights. And so this is a horrendous thing to say, we're just not going to have a vote because the governor decided so. And understand, if he's really talking about saving people's lives because he doesn't want them to congregate for a vote for the virus or something, that's nonsense, because 40 of the 65 counties of New York, or 40 of the 63 counties of New York, to be exact, are going to have primaries anyway, because forget the presidential contest, you have, you know, primaries for Congress and school board and everything else. So you're still going to have this election. You're just going to remove the presidential line. And technically, he's not even doing that. He's saying you'll only have one candidate on the ballot. Now, yes, you can write in Sanders, or, you know, I mean, but you'll only have one candidate on the ballot, according, because he's chosen that candidate for you. That's really quite extraordinary. So Sanders is upset also because they wanted delegates to influence the outcome. I can tell you, for example, why is this important? You think, well, who cares about the platforms and everything else? It is important. I remember in 2016, Josh Fox was able, as a Bernie Sanders delegate, rewrote the Democratic Party's line on which would prevent licensing of new fossil fuel plants, gas and coal. And that was huge. And that was only because Sanders basically went to the Clinton people and said, we're rewriting this chapter or you're not getting our support. He needs the delegate votes. He needs, you know, he needs those delegates so he can influence the direction of the party.
Now, I don't mean to be soiling Andrew Cuomo. Did I say Mario before? Andrew Cuomo. But there are many reasons to really question him outside of the good job he's been doing basically in New York. I mean, this is somebody who's now partnering up, locking arms with Bill Gates, talking about virtual teaching. And he's got some ideas that sort of begin to gently set aside the public school system. That's another thing I think that's bothering Sanders as well.
Well, it's not so gentle. I mean, let's, you know, Andrew Cuomo is earning his cred by confronting Donald Trump more sometimes on the coronavirus, because you've got this, he's in the, his state is the epicenter. And that's positive. And there's, he's willing to take on the issue and be forthright. The problem is, or it's not the problem, you just have to decide whether it's your cup of tea. He's a very conservative Democrat. Actually, you mentioned his father, who's known as the great liberal. He wasn't, not as a governor. And Andrew Cuomo is very, very close. He has a special PAC set up for him by real estate interests. He is very close to the, you know, to the end public schooling. He's been very hostile to the public school systems in New York. And, yeah, so he's a very conservative Democrat. And, obviously, the last thing he wants is for is to end up with a vote in New York that looks like California, where Bernie Sanders people lead the delegation and he's merely tolerated. That's not what a power broker wants, since he knows he can't win the vote straight. Because remember, there were a lot of voting problems in 2016. Literally a couple hundred thousand Sanders voters were blocked from voting, and this time they have corrected a lot of the voting problems. So it looks like, despite having, you know, suspended his campaign, there's a very good chance that Sanders would win the New York primary. And for Cuomo, that would be politically devastating. So it's all about it's all about Andrew Cuomo. I'm doing it now, too. Andrew Cuomo and his political career, and not about democracy. But this is very dangerous. I think that Sanders, well, I don't want to put my guess what Sanders is thinking. I know that they have expressed great upset with deciding that democracy doesn't count in New York. Though I have to say, it was Andrew Yang's people that actually brought the court case against shutting down the primary. So ups and props to Andrew Yang.
All right, we have a minute left. Obviously, we're going to keep doing the Crimes Bulletin. It's going to get more and more urgent. And folks are going to be doing a lot of stuff under the cover of the pandemic. So we have a hard job ahead of us. But what's the one thing you want to leave us with, Greg, that we should be thinking about as we try and protect our free elections in the face of COVID-19?
If one, please check your registration. 16.9 million people have been purged in the last 2 years. There's a very good chance that it's you. I checked, and Greg Palast was missing as a voter in California. If you are in New York and you have not voted in New York before you've moved, you can re-register to May 29. You know anyone in New York, tell them to check their registrations right now. If they've been purged, they can register. And please, it's not California. It's a closed primary in New York. If you want to vote, I'm not telling you to vote as a Democrat, but if you want to vote in the Democratic primary, you have to change your party affiliation from independent or whatever you have to Democrat. And by the way, if you are not registered as a Democrat right now and you're already registered as a voter in New York, the state of New York will not let you re-register as a Democrat to vote in the primary. Sorry. That's New York rules stink, and you just, and that's the truth. That's, you're stuck with it. If you are not a Democrat now and you're registered in New York, you can't vote in the primary.
All right, we're going to leave it there for now. Greg Palast, we thank you. We really appreciate doing this weekly series, the Election Crimes Bulletin, and more to come. Thanks, Greg. People can check out all that Greg is up to, and that's a great deal, at gregpalast.com. Thanks.
And that's ex-Brooklynite Dennis Bernstein, close to the New York scene in his heart. And well, Greg Palast is originally from Chicago, but he's now a South Californian guy, though he does get around, as Dennis was pointing out. That's a bit of an interesting analysis I haven't heard anywhere else, and that's, I guess, why I bring it to you. Well, I'm not going to be playing the tax cast, but I recommend it to you. I had excerpted a section where it talks about how these zombie corporations were already in trouble, and now they're getting bailed out. And let's see, was it the airline industry that's paid out $50 million in dividends, etc., and now they're now they want some help getting through because they gave all their money to their stockholders instead of investing in their system and having a rainy day fund. All right, opinions you hear are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others. If we're going to get to any of the Virginia Sperry who has an article up on Intercepted about prisons as a reservoir and vector for COVID, so it's going to be around for a while. And, okay, let's go right to that right now. This is a fellow, Sonali Kalhatar also had a good interview with a person from this same organization that had this virtual protest. They don't mention in here that Mitch McConnell has been cajoling and pressuring, and in one way or another, getting rid of some of the older Republican justices so he can replace them with younger and maybe even more conservative justices, giving the justices who semi-retire an emeritus status and probably a pretty full paycheck. So it's another way of just further stacking the court. This is more centered on and this guy, the reason why I'm playing this one and not the other one is because he emphasizes over and over the idea that they're talking about a crony of his from Kentucky when they could be talking about what next to do for the COVID crisis and the economic ramifications. And instead, they're talking about getting a buddy of his and Kavanaugh on the district court fast track to the Supremes. So this one is with Dennis, also from Flashpoints.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We're speaking to you from San Francisco today, and we're delighted to welcome for the first time to these airwaves Mike Zubrinsky. He's chief counsel and legal director for the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. And they were part of a virtual protest today having to do with what's happening in the Senate, and particularly what's happening with the potential appointment of a federal judge, an appeals court judge. Mike Zubrinsky, welcome to Flashpoints.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's good to have you with us. You did have a virtual rally today to oppose the appointment of Justin Walker. This is a personal friend of Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader. Could you just sort of outline why you held the virtual protest and what your problem is with this nominee?
Yes, I would be happy to. As you alluded to a minute ago, Mitch McConnell, the majority leader of the Senate, brought the Senate back to Washington this week not to deal with essential legislation during this incredible public health emergency that we are suffering from, this global pandemic that is worse than any crisis many of us have ever experienced in our lifetimes. Mitch McConnell brought the Senate back not to deal with the COVID-19 crisis, but to process judges. And in particular, Justin Walker, his old family friend, a former intern to Senator McConnell, and a crony of Senator McConnell. This is somebody who Mitch McConnell has brought the Senate back for, even though there are stay-at-home orders still in place in Washington, D.C., and the Capitol physician advised both the House and Senate to stay away from Washington at least for another short period of time until the pandemic is, the impact of it is diminished to some extent. But Justin Walker, he's 37 years old, and he fits the bill for what Mitch McConnell and President Trump are trying to do to our federal courts, packing the courts with young, mostly white, mostly male extremists who will be serving for life. These are lifetime appointments. And so someone like Justin Walker, who's only 37, he could be serving for 50, 60 years on this federal appeals court, which is the most influential appeals court in the country after the U.S. Supreme Court. And you asked, you know, what's our problem with Justin Walker? I know we have a limited amount of time, so I'll just hit a couple of highlights.
Please.
He, in his very brief legal career of just 11 years, he's only 11 years out of law school, he has been a real partisan activist. He was a law clerk to Brett Kavanaugh when Kavanaugh was himself a D.C. circuit judge. And in 2018, during the Kavanaugh confirmation process, Justin Walker served as really the chief lobbyist for Brett Kavanaugh. Walker did 162 media interviews during the summer of 2018. It was really a full-time job. He was doing 3-4 interviews a day. And so part of his judgeship, in addition to a judgeship he received last year, he's a Kentucky trial court judge right now. He was nominated for that position about a year ago, and he's been serving only for a few months. And that was a reward, sort of, for that judgeship, in addition to the appeals court nomination that he has right now. These are really political payoffs for the political services that he rendered during the Kavanaugh confirmation battle in 2018. During that fight, Walker went on TV every day and accused the Senate Democrats of all kinds of things. Said that they had a search and destroy mission against Brett Kavanaugh. Said that their whole process of weighing his nomination was a deceptive farce. And also during that process, Walker wrote about the Affordable Care Act, and because he was trying to make the case that Brett Kavanaugh, if he were confirmed, would strike down the ACA, because Justin Walker agrees with Brett Kavanaugh that the ACA is unconstitutional. And so Walker himself wrote about the ACA and said it was indefensible, it was catastrophic, and he said these are Brett Kavanaugh's views as well. And so more recently, Justin Walker has done some alarming things. Just in the few months he's been a judge, he had an investiture in mid-March, and this received some headlines because Mitch McConnell recessed the Senate just so that McConnell could fly back to Kentucky and attend this investiture for Justin Walker. This was right when the pandemic was starting to heat up, and Congress was really bending over backwards, working overtime to try to come up with legislation that would send money to the American people, because we all knew that there would be mass firings, mass unemployment, and there was a great need for Congress to reform our unemployment insurance system, our sick leave system, and just to get money to small businesses and individuals so that they could weather the storm. In the middle of that, McConnell recessed the Senate for several days so that he could fly to Kentucky for this investiture for Justin Walker. And at that investiture, Justin Walker was, again, talk more like a Fox News analyst than a judge. He just said a number of very inflammatory and controversial things. One of the things he said at his investiture was, "In Brett Kavanaugh's America, we will not surrender while you wage war on our work, or our cause or our hope or our dream. I mean, this, you know, Justin Walker is a conservative revolutionary.
And this is a, we should point out, we're having this conversation on a day when Ruth Bader Ginsburg is participating in the Supreme Court arguments from the hospital. Let me tell people, we're speaking with Mike Zubrinsky. He's the chief counsel and legal director for the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. They had a virtual protest today, if you will, regarding this appointment. So here's Mitch McConnell, who leaves town during a crucial time where legislation, recovery legislation, is being worked on. But he now comes back and he calls the Senate, he convenes the Senate. We should say the average age of senators is over 65, but somehow this is vital. Is there some reason why he's rushing? I understand this proceeding isn't even necessary until September.
Yeah, that's right. This vacancy on the D.C. Circuit does not become vacant until September. And McConnell is rushing to get Walker confirmed well before then, even though he would not be able to take his seat on the bench until September. I mean, this is all part of McConnell's larger plan to pack the courts with lifetime appointments who are not going to be fair and neutral. These judges that Trump is appointing, especially at the circuit court level, the level right below the Supreme Court, almost every single one of the 51 or so judges that Trump has been able to put on the federal courts, almost every single one of them is a member of the arch-conservative Federalist Society, which was started a couple of decades ago for this very reason, to try to lard the federal bench with right-wing zealots who do not view cases even-handedly. They have an agenda on abortion rights, on church-state separation issues, on affirmative action, voting rights, immigration issues, LGBT issues. You can go on and on. These judges who are appointed by Trump, they all have track records of hostility to the civil and human rights that organizations like mine and many Americans, millions of Americans, care very deeply about.
We certainly don't know, we don't need to do a deep investigation to understand how important the appointment of federal judges, right-wing federal judges, have been to the Trump administration. And a large chunk of his committed support has everything to do with his forceful support with McConnell, sort of the 1-2 in terms of packing the courts across the country, the federal courts, with right-wing judges. This is going to live with us for a long time. It is interesting that McConnell is sort of now accusing the House and Nancy Pelosi of, I guess, a bit of laziness. They don't want to come and do their job. And here's Senator McConnell ready to deal with the bailout or the recovery, the next recovery bill. But of course, that has been sort of questionable because McConnell has also talked about, well, he's made random statements like maybe the states should be allowed to go bankrupt, declare bankruptcy, and maybe we have to get some legislation that protects, say, the industrial meat packers if, in fact, they end up getting sued by the hundreds and thousands of people who are being made sick by being forced to go back to work. Final comments on this, the crucial nature of this event, and why you all feel so strongly about this resistance to this particular judge.
Yeah, I mean, you hit the nail on the head. I mean, here we are in the middle of this global pandemic, and McConnell's top priority is rewarding his former intern, who has an extreme view on healthcare and doesn't want healthcare and people with pre-existing conditions in America to receive healthcare. He wants the ACA to be struck down, and with judges like this, more and more of them being appointed to the federal courts, that's what we're going to see. And instead of dealing with the issues, the life-saving and job-saving types of legislation that Congress could be involved in, and doing the types of hearings, instead of having a hearing today on this controversial judicial nominee, we could have had a hearing about the impact of the pandemic on the American people, what it's going to mean for people trying to exercise their right to vote in November, what we've already seen many primaries postponed. We could have done the hearing, or the Senate could have had the hearing on the need to provide more protective equipment for law enforcement, for prison guards, or liability for businesses, the issue you mentioned about meatpacking plants. But that's not what they're doing a hearing on. They're doing hearings on these extreme judicial nominees, and it really just shows you what the far-right Republicans care about, who are in control of the Senate and the White House today.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it right there. But Mr. Zabrinsky, we thank you for taking the time out. Again, let me tell people that you're now Chief Counsel and Legal Director for the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. Between 2010 and 2017, you served as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Legal Policy at the U.S. Department of Justice and a lot more. But we're going to leave it there. And we thank you again for joining us on Flashpoints.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
You're so welcome. And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to take
another excerpt. Now we're going to go to South California with KPFK's Sonali Kalhatar. We'll only hear a moment of that. Civilrights.org is the name of this website. And his name in alphabetical order was Mike Zabrinsky, Chief Counsel. And they have a lot of staff. Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. I like the inclusion of human rights as well. There's a long argument to be made there. But I want to turn it over to Sonali Kalhatar of Rising Up with Sonali. It's a morning show on the Left Coast, but it's getting featured a little more prominently. She has an interview with Virginia Sperry, S-P-E-R-I. The name rang a bell. I think she's really good. And we'll present just a taste of this. Her article on The Intercept, it is called Mass Incarceration Poses a Uniquely American Risk in the COVID pandemic. And the first paragraph kind of sets it up. They probably do this in the article too, but for emphasis, there is a fundamental flaw in the models the Trump administration officials have used to project the curve of the outbreak as it rips across the U.S. Their models are based on other countries' experience with the virus from China to Italy and do not account for the uniquely American risk factor, or U.S. risk factor, mass incarceration. So that's the premise of the article, and I also haven't heard this discussion done anywhere else. So we'll hear Sonali do her introduction. You can find her. It's also a video. I think it's done remotely, so it might be a Zoom replay recording. So about 8 minutes of this, just to give you a sample and maybe the basic thesis as outlined. Doug Henwood has one interview with Jody Dean, a frequent guest. Jody Dean, and she's going to be interviewed just about the crisis, the crisis capital. So we know what that is. And the other one is about the left and guns, which could be another iconoclastic interview, I guess. Anyway, here's a few minutes with Sonali.
From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. As Americans struggle with the coronavirus pandemic, the government appears to be ignoring the fate of a significant portion of the U.S. population, the incarcerated. Millions of people are held behind bars in local county jails and state and federal prisons. Considering the lack of an organized federal plan to tackle the spread of the virus overall, it's no surprise that prisons are being left to their own devices. And given the close quarters that prisoners are held in, COVID-19 has spread like wildfire inside facilities. Many states are only now scrambling to test inmates and finding serious waves of infection that could hurt prisoners, prison guards, and others. According to my guest, the Trump administration has failed to account for the uniquely American risk factor of our mass incarceration. The data is grim, and Alice Sperry, writing in The Intercept, shares that, quote, in the handful of facilities with higher test rates, most people were found to be positive. 8 of the 10 largest outbreaks in the country are in prisons and jails. Alice Sperry is a reporter for The Intercept, specializing in justice, immigration, and civil rights. She now joins me from Italy. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you write how widespread these infections are in U.S. jails and prisons. Is it fair to assume that most prisons where there has been even one infection are likely a place where there are now majorities infected, and as we test, we find that out?
I think it's a fair assumption. We are testing far too few people everywhere, really, but particularly in prisons. And in the few facilities that have tested most people have also been found to be positive. And I think one thing, you know, it's obvious there is no way to socially distance in prison. I mean, there are hundreds of people living together, sharing tables, sharing dorms. It is extremely difficult to maintain CDC guidelines in prison. There are also the question of protective equipment and protective gear. I mean, some prisons have started to give inmates access to masks or face coverings, but very late in the game. Some prisons are isolating the sick, but only those with symptoms, and we know that the virus spreads among asymptomatic people as well. So it's really just a terrible set of circumstances. And advocates, attorneys, anyone that's paying any attention to criminal justice issues in the country have been raising the alarm about this for weeks. So the deaths that we're now seeing in prisons that are really climbing by the day were absolutely predicted and predictable and avoidable, really.
Are they even counting infections and deaths in the national totals?
We have numbers. So first of all, one important point that my article makes is that there is no standardized data about this. There is no centralized repository of all this data, right? Because the criminal justice system by its nature is very fragmented. We have state prisons in 50 different states. We have a federal prison system that's run by the Bureau of Prisons. And then we have 3,000 jails that are run by local jurisdictions, right? So there is no one place where all of this data sits, and there is no standard in how prisons and jails are testing. And of course, on top of this, we have immigration detention facilities and facilities for youth as well. So we do have a few different projects, independent projects, that have been tracking infections and tracking deaths. And the most accurate and the most comprehensive, rather, I have come across is one that's run out of UCLA. And they have collected all of this data from all of these different jurisdictions and found that as of this week, more than 21,000 incarcerated people across the country were infected. However, the same project also found that 295 people had died after contracting the virus in prison and jails. And if you run the numbers, you realize that the number of infected that we know of is just not a realistic number. We know it's a massive undercount. And we know that there are many, many people who are not getting tested. I wrote a story just last week about the New Jersey prison system where 34 people have died already and only 185 had been tested at that point, which really gives you a sense of the disparity in access. Also, a lot of states are reporting staff infections as well, and we're seeing those numbers that are much higher. And it is not because corrections officers are getting infected more. It is just because they're getting tested more.
Staff as an S-T-A-F-F as opposed to S-T-A-P-H. So given that the federal government has essentially left all Americans to their own devices, the White House guidelines are vague, the CDC has guidelines, but they're being suppressed. Has anybody in the federal government, has the Bureau of Prisons, have any federal agencies actually laid out any sort of document, any guideline, any direction for how states should be handling their prison in populations, and even how the federal government itself should be handling the federal prison population?
Well, first of all, the way the federal government has handled the federal prison population is definitely no standard to go by. I mean, we've had a lot of infections, a lot of deaths in the federal prison system that were, again, totally avoidable. There have been a number of very vague guidelines. Attorney General Barr has put out a letter that's basically encouraging states to consider releasing some incarcerated people, and some states have done so. I mean, one point to make is that states have moved to release some people. The problem is that is hardly making a dent in the density of the population we have. And that is just because the U.S. incarcerates far too many people. I mean, we have 2.3 million people that are either in jail or prison or some other kind of detention right now. And, you know, you have a few hundred people being released here and there, but that's not really making any significant impact on the problem. The other problem with the criminal justice system, and this is an issue always, and if anything, the pandemic is kind of highlighting this issue that's been a problem forever, is that it is such a decentralized system that there's no actual one place where, you know, responsibility and accountability and decision making happens. We have all of these power holders and all of these jurisdictions across the country that also make it very difficult for advocates and attorneys to target any one particular body for advocacy, right? Because you could be pushing your governor to do something, you could be pushing judges and district attorneys to you know, refuse to prosecute certain low-level crimes. There are a number of actors you could kind of lobby for action in this situation. And you know, attorneys and advocacy groups are doing that across the country, but it is a very painstaking, it's very difficult work when you have so many different centers of power in the system and so little data, which is, again, a point I come back to a lot.
So this underlying issue of the fact that we simply incarcerate too many people is one that activists and advocates have already been raising for many, many years. I'm sure there's been warnings of what could happen if there were a massive infection. And in fact, jails and prisons have been sites where infections of other diseases have spread. This is seemingly an issue that the U.S. ought not to be surprised is coming to haunt us now.
Absolutely. And, you know, the number of people incarcerated is certainly part of the problem, but there's also the length of the sentences that people are given, right? There is an aging population in U.S. prisons. We have more than 200,000 people who are over the age of 55 who are incarcerated. That number has spiked by nearly 300% in the last two decades. We know that 40% of incarcerated people have at least one chronic condition, like asthma or diabetes, and we know that these are, you know, conditions that make someone particularly susceptible to COVID-19. So we have a number of health issues that prisons have been dealing with. And in a way, mass incarceration has been dealing with this kind of mass public health problem for a long time. And COVID-19 has just kind of exacerbated all those problems. Another part of that story is the question of jails. So in prison, which is where people who have been convicted of crimes are sent, we tend to have an older population and a population with, you know, a lot of health problems. In jail, which is where people are held pre-trial or in some cases where people are held for misdemeanor convictions.